Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And now I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Sheila Wiener. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to the National Kidney Foundation's People Like Us Coffee House Conversations telephone series. I'm Sheila Wiener, Patient Services Director with the National Kidney Foundation, and I'm so pleased you're able to join us today for the second call in a series about the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid new conditions for coverage for end-stage renal disease facilities. On our last call about the conditions for coverage, we learned about how the dialysis centers were going to be affected by these new conditions that were implemented in all dialysis centers around the country on October 14, 2008. And we learned about how the conditions for coverage were developed. You can listen to this call on our website at any time. Just go to www.kidney.org/coffeehouse. While these calls are intended for patients and their loved ones, we welcome the professionals who are listening in as well. Today we will hear from three expert faculty panel members. Each will speak for about 15 minutes, and following the three presentations, we will begin a question and answer session. So hold off on your questions, but keep them in mind for our session following the presentation. Our first speaker today is Kelly Frank. Kelly is a registered nurse who has been a surveyor with the state of Iowa for 18 years, and she's been surveying dialysis facilities for 10 years. So she certainly has the qualifications we're looking for this talk today. Kelly is a member of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Conditions for Coverage Transition Team, and she was involved in developing materials to help the surveyors with the survey process and to help teach the surveys about the surveyors about the new conditions for coverage. Today, Kelly is going to present about several topics, including the physical environment in the dialysis center, safety in the dialysis center, staffing and personnel issues. Thank you, Kelly. You can begin now.
Thank you, Sheila. Good afternoon, everybody, and I'm very glad to be here. As Sheila said, I'm a surveyor. Every state has surveyors who make on-site visits to dialysis facilities to inspect the facilities for compliance with the regulation. All the surveys are unannounced, meaning that the facilities don't know that we're coming to do the survey. The regulations are basically rules the dialysis facility must follow. Dialysis facilities have to meet the requirements specified in the regulations or in these rules. The inspections by the surveyor include evaluation to determine if those facility systems and if the staff are providing safe and effective treatments to the patients. The new regulations or rules do have a section specifically titled patient safety, and I'll address those areas. The first one is the water and dialysate quality. The old rules had a few areas for water and dialysate. The new rules have many that are now clear and specific requirements the facility must meet to ensure that the water and dialysate is safe. The water is important because product water, which is the water that's produced from the facility's water treatment system, and the dialysate are an important part of the dialysis treatment because the water is used to make that dialysate for the dialysis treatment. The dialysate flows through that patient's dialyzer, and it helps clean the patient's blood. Plus, that product water is used during the reprocessing of patient dialyzers if that facility practices reuse, and not every facility does, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. The facilities and surveyors take water and dialysate very seriously because water that doesn't meet the requirements and the regulations can make patients very sick, cause patients even to be hospitalized or even to die. The water is important because patients patients are exposed to a lot more water through the dialysis treatment than if somebody would just drink water. And those chemicals and contaminants in the water, which are harmless in the drinking water, can be actually very harmful or even toxic to the patient when present in the dialysate. Dialysis facilities, they must have a water treatment system that produces safe water and systems for monitoring and maintaining that water in dialysate so it's safe for the patient treatment. The regulations now address requirements for the components of the water treatment system, and in the old rules or regulations, it didn't address those components at all. The regulations address the maximum allowable level of chemical contaminants in the water that's used for the dialysate and the dialysis treatment and to reprocess dialyzer. The requirements do include that chemical contaminant analysis be done at least annually. Chlorine and chloramine in the water make the drinking water safe. However, chlorine and chloramine can be very dangerous to the patient's overall health, and it affects every patient. The requirements now specify the frequency that the chlorine and chloramine test must be done, and there are also now specific requirements on actions that facility must take if that chlorine and or chloramine level are elevated, including to not initiate the dialysis treatment or to discontinue patient treatment. So if your treatment is discontinued during your dialysis treatment, it may be that staff identified a concern and had to take action. The regulations do specify levels for bacteria and endotoxins in the water and dialysate. And endotoxins are just basically the remains of bacteria after the bacteria have died. And this is, again, important because bacteria and endotoxins in the water and dialysate can make patients very sick. Facilities are now required to test the water and dialysate for both the bacteria and endotoxin levels, and this is a change from the former regulations. In addition, the new regulations specify the frequency that the testing for these bacteria and endotoxin must be done, which is monthly, and the sites for that testing. The new requirements also reduce the allowable level for those endotoxins and for that bacteria in the dialysate. Facilities are required to check and monitor the water treatment system components and take action if the readings and findings are outside of acceptable ranges, and many of these checks are required daily. There are also new requirements for the water treatment system technicians. Technicians who perform monitoring and testing of the water treatment system must complete a training program that has been approved by the medical director and governing body. I've been at a dialysis facility before and experienced when dialysis treatments have been delayed because the facility's test results for the water weren't within a safe level. And I know that patients can get upset with this, but keep in mind that if the facility found a concern with the water and therefore delayed the dialysis treatment, it's for the patient's safety. And it meant that staff identified the problem because they were doing what's required. And I kind of think of it like an airplane. When a flight's been delayed on an airplane because of mechanical problems, it's better to have caught the concern prior to taking off on that airplane rather than to have identified that problem during the flight. Okay, the next area is reuse of dialyzers. Facilities can use single-use dialyzers for the treatment, and that means that the dialyzer is used for one patient treatment and then discarded. Our facilities can also use multiple-use dialyzers for the dialysis for the treatment, meaning that dialyzer can be used multiple times or over and over again. The reprocessing of dialyzers actually refers to the process of cleaning and instilling germicide into that dialyzer. And reuse refers to the use of the reprocessed dialyzer for the dialysis treatment. Some facilities do use reprocessed dialyzers, but not every clinic does. If the facility does reprocess dialyzer, that dialyzer must be assigned to a specific patient. The regulations do not specify the maximum number of times that dialyzer can be reprocessed or reused, but each facility may set a maximum number of times the dialyzer can be reprocessed or reused. The regulations do specify certain tests and criteria that dialyzer must meet for continued use, and if that criteria or those tests aren't met, then that dialyzer is discarded. The reprocessing of dialyzers has economic benefits for this facility and environmental benefits, such as it can lower costs for dialysis or decrease the consumption of resources used to produce the dialyzer and reduces the amount of dialyzers at the landfills. Reprocessing and reuse of that patient dialyzer do have those specific requirements that have to be met. And like with any process or any procedure, there are associated risks and hazards if the staff don't follow all of those required processes and procedures. Some examples may include infections and reactions to the germicide. And also, staff have to be trained and competent in the reprocessing and reuse tasks. There is a regulation or rule that all patients in a dialysis facility must be informed regarding the reuse of dialyzers. However, the regulations do not require specific written consent for dialyzer reuse. Be aware that some facilities may require consent and some facilities may not. The regulations do require verification of the germicidal contact and to make sure that germicide is in the dialyzer for the appropriate time. Also, there must be a system to make sure that germicide has been rinsed out of that dialyzer and that there's an absence of germicide in the dialyzer prior to use. Reprocessing records must be kept for that dialyzer, and there is a requirement that the patients are permitted to read those records related to the reprocessing and reuse of their own dialyzers. The rules include that each patient have their own dialyzer and that the dialyzer is used only for that patient. The labeling of the dialyzer must identify the patient who's using that dialyzer. Dialyzers of patients with similar names have to have a warning that to take extra care in ensuring that the name or other information of that dialyzer is that patient. And usually the patient may see a sticker on that dialyzer. Sometimes it's red to show that there is another person that has a similar name to theirs. Few people should check that first and last names on that dialyzer, that the first and last names on that dialyzer and any other identifying information correspond to the identifying information on that patient's permanent record. If possible, one of the persons checking identification should be the patient. Also, the final check that patient's dialyzer should be done when that patient is at the dialysis station, when that patient is actually present at the dialysis station. There's also a requirement that dialyzer must be aesthetically acceptable in appearance to the patient and staff. If the patient does not think that dialyzer is aesthetically acceptable, the patient should tell the staff that they don't want to use that dialyzer and the facility needs to respect that patient's request. The requirements include that the patient's blood and delivered dose of dialysis be monitored along with expected weight loss. And if the patient does not meet those expected results, the overall effectiveness of the entire treatment must be evaluated. The facility's physician or director must establish a training course for the persons performing the dialyzer reprocessing, and the regulations are very specific on the curriculum for the course. Each person that performs procedures for multiple use of the dialyzer, they have to have successfully completed a training course and demonstrated competency in all those areas. The next area is physical environment. Again, the regulations are more specific for physical environment and exciting also. The regulations now include that there be a safe environment, and that could mean that there be no obstacles in the walkways, which could present risk for trips or falls, and no loose tiles, no broken surfaces that could be an infection control risk. The dialysis treatment chairs also must be in proper functioning condition. The facility must maintain a comfortable temperature and make reasonable accommodations for the patients who are not comfortable at that temperature. For an example, an acceptable plan may be to set the thermostat actually at a reasonable temperature, inform patients and staff what that temperature is set at, and suggest patients may want to bring a light blanket or gloves or hat if they're cold, or even moving the patient to a warmer or cooler area in the facility where the patient's more comfortable. The facility also must have a quality assessment and performance improvement program that monitors the assessment and improvement of care in the facility. This does include medical injuries and medical error identification. The requirements include that the facility must comply, and the facility's team must review those reports and complaints related to any patient or staff injuries and treatment or medication errors. An example of an injury would be a patient fall, And an example of a treatment error is an error in the dialysis prescription. Injuries and errors also could include, for example, staph needle sticks. The error should be identified with data and information related to the errors collected, reviewed, and trended. The facility must take actions to reduce or prevent injury or error from occurring again. Okay, infection control. The old rules only had a few areas for infection control, and now the new rules have many specific requirements. There must be a sufficient number of hand washing sinks with warm water and soap. Hand washing sinks should be dedicated only for hand washing and remain clean. And there also needs to be a sink available for patients to wash their access sites prior to treatment and their hands. And this may be the same sink that staff use to wash their hands. There should not be patient clamps or items from the patient's dialysis treatment set in the sink. Staff must also wear gloves when caring for the patient or touching equipment such as the dialysis machine at the dialysis station. Staff must remove those gloves and wash hands between each patient or station. And hand washing does include the use of soap or water or the use of a hand sanitizer. Gloves should be provided to patients and visitors if they assist with procedures such as doing their own needle cannulation, or holding access sites after the dialysis treatment. This is a new area in the requirements. Staff should wash hands after touching that computer keyboard or the screens and before any contact with the patient. Patients should see staff wash their hands after touching one patient or their machine, or caring for one or providing care at one dialysis station after leaving that dialysis station, and then before arriving to care for another patient or touching another patient's dialysis machine. Staff should not be carrying items in their pockets or moving items such as tape from dialysis station to dialysis station. Items taken into that patient dialysis station should be either disposed of, dedicated for use only on a single patient, or clean and disinfected before being taken to a common clean area or used on another patient. When the patient arrives at that treatment chair and machine should look clean. There shouldn't be any visible blood on the floor or on the chair. If you see that, you do need to tell staff about that. Part of the patient rights include that the patient be informed of facility policies regarding patient care, which would include that an isolation station. Patients should be aware that facilities may have an isolation room or area to isolate patients. If the isolation room is used for hepatitis B positive patients, then while a hepatitis B positive patient is a patient at that facility, only hepatitis B positive patients can dialyze in that room. The new rules include education and training requirements for new and existing staff, and include that training and education must occur annually. The next area is special purpose dialysis facilities. Special purpose dialysis facilities are approved to furnish dialysis on a short-term basis at special locations. And these special purpose dialysis facilities are divided into two groups. These include the vacation camps, and these are locations that serve dialysis patients while the patients are in a temporary residence, such as the vacation camps for children, and facilities established to serve dialysis patients under emergency circumstances, such as Hurricane Katrina. A hospital or long-term care facility or other provider could also request a certification for a special purpose dialysis facility to provide dialysis to patients that were denied outpatient dialysis by all other facilities within a reasonable driving distance because of medical complications, such as the patient has a tracheostomy or is dependent on a respirator, or has a history of disruptive or threatening behaviors. The period for approval for a special purpose dialysis facility cannot exceed 8 months in a 12-month period. Camps that provide only peritoneal dialysis on site, they're not required to be certified because the treatment provided would be considered a home treatment. The special purpose dialysis facilities are limited to areas in which there are limited dialysis resources or access to care problems due to an emergency circumstance. A special purpose dialysis facility may provide services only to those patients who would otherwise be unable to obtain treatment in the geographic locations serviced by that facility. Personnel regarding staffing, training, and administration. Some of the changes with staff and training include more specific requirements for nurses, medical director, and patient care technicians. And we'll start by talking about the patient care technicians. The training, education, and certification are new areas in the regulations. Patient care technicians are now required to meet all applicable state requirements and have a high school diploma or equivalency, or at least 4 years dialysis work experience as of October 14th of this year. The minimum competencies include completion of a registered nurse-directed training program approved by the medical director, and the training program must focus on the operation of equipment and machines, providing direct patient care, and communication and interpersonal skills, including patient sensitivity training and care of difficult patients. Competencies also include that patient care technician be certified by a federally approved state or nationally certifying program, and that continuing certification is also required. All patient care technicians who are not yet certified must have successfully completed an approved training program before they can independently provide patient care. Patient care dialysis technicians working on October 14th of this year, of 2008, who are not yet certified under this approved program, must be certified before April 15th of 2010. Patient care technicians hired after October 14th of 2008 must be certified within 18 months of their hire date as a patient care technician. For staff, the requirements include that an adequate number of qualified and trained staff are present whenever patients are on dialysis so that the patient-staff ratio is appropriate to the level of dialysis care given and meets the needs of the patient. The registered nurse, social worker, and dietitian must be available to meet the clinical needs of the patient. The regulation or rules, they don't give a number for a patient-to-staff ratio. However, facilities are expected to meet any state rules that identify special patient-to-staff ratio requirements. New in the rules is that a registered nurse who is responsible for nursing care provided is present in the facility at all times that in-center dialysis patients are being treated. The medical director's job responsibilities and accountabilities have expanded with these new rules. In addition, the requirement that the facility only has one single medical director, that's a new requirement. The old rules allowed for more than one medical director. That medical director is accountable to the governing body for the quality of care provided to the patient. Well, I'd like to thank you for having me share this information. The new regulations are very exciting, and they do encourage patient involvement, and the result will be to provide better patient care for the patients with better patient outcomes. So thank you very much.
Kelly, thank you for that very informative presentation. I think we're all reassured to hear that the new conditions for coverage provide much more detail regarding safety in dialysis units compared with the previous regulations. Let's welcome our next speaker, Norma Knowles. Norma is a member of the National Kidney Foundation's Patient and Family Council Executive Committee and also a member of the Council of Nephrology Social Workers. Norma is a clinical social worker who's worked in nephrology for 10 years. She also has family that has a long history of kidney disease due to hereditary kidney disease. Having experienced several treatment modalities for kidney failure, Norma had a living-related transplant in 1998, and is now on home hemodialysis. Norma is a strong advocate for promoting patients' quality of life. Welcome, Norma.
Thank you, Sheila. As Sheila mentioned, I'm currently a dialysis patient. After my transplant failed, I returned to in-center hemo for about 4 months, while I trained for doing home hemo using the Next Stage system. I've been on home hemo for 2.5 years now, and I hope to give you all some insight from the perspective of a patient regarding safety and environmental issues. To begin, safety regulations for dialysis is the same for home patients as they are for in-center patients. However, home patients have different considerations in meeting those regulations given their home setting environment. When patients come in-center for treatment, as was mentioned earlier, staff are expected to follow universal precautions and procedures for minimizing risk for contamination and infection. It's important that in-center patients be familiar with infection control and safety practices, such as the wearing of gloves and gowns and hand washing, like was mentioned. And if you're a patient and you notice something that's not done correctly, you need to bring it to the attention of the supervisor to be corrected for your safety and peace of mind. As I mentioned, safe infection control is as important in the home setting as it is in-center. In the home setting, patients will have home visits at least yearly from their clinic staff, more often if there's a change in your care partner or your home environment. Since the nurses are not in your home when you do dialysis, it's your responsibility as a patient to follow procedures for safety and infection control and report any concerns or problems to your nurses or your health care team. Your clinic is required to provide home patients education and PPE, protective equipment, which includes the gloves and gowns and shields, just like are used in-center for you to use at home, as well as training on good hand-washing technique. In-center, nurses are careful, or should be, to wash their hands and change gloves between patients. Some home patients may think, why should I wear gloves? They're my germs anyway, it won't make a difference, I'm in my own house. But remember where you've been and what you've been doing prior to your treatment. Did you take out the trash? Did you play with your cat or your dog? Did you help your kids with some art project? Anything that has germs. Washing hands is extremely important in preventing cross-contamination, and failure to follow these procedures could lead to infection in your PD catheter or your hemo access. An important factor with home patients is we sometimes think we can go wash our hands in the sink and use the towel that's there for everyone to use. But for me and for home patients, we need to have paper towels and disposable things in our treatment area so that community washcloths or hand towels aren't used to spread germs to us as a patient. Monitoring your access for signs and symptoms of infection is also extremely important, whether you have a fistula, a hemodialysis catheter, or a PD catheter. It's important to do a daily assessment, a physical assessment, to look for redness, swelling, tenderness, or drainage, and report any concerns to your nurses right away. When you're in-center, you're going to have a nurse to look at your access several times a week. For home patients, a lot can happen in between your monthly clinic visits, and it's important for you to be aware of what to look for and what to report. It's also a good idea for home in-center patients to be aware, but like I mentioned, you're going to have more frequent monitoring from your nurses than you do as a home patient. Water is also an important issue to monitor with dialysis. As was mentioned earlier, CMS requires that your water is monitored and cultured regularly, and for home patients, they require a quarterly water culture in order to ensure that there aren't any concerns with contamination in the water. When you're testing your water at home, one of the new requirements is that patients need to be able to read a color-coded test strip and pass a colorblind test because they're color-coded, and if you're colorblind, you might not be able to read the water accurately, and you may have a problem and not realize it. This is where your care partner can come into play and help you with that. Not being able to read it as a colorblind person wouldn't be a barrier, but you need to count on your care partner to help you with that step. Some other environmental factors for home patients to be aware of to help with safety and infection control include cleaning your machine and your treatment area with bleach or an antibacterial cleaner after each treatment. If you have a day off between treatments, it's always good to do it before your treatment and make sure that there isn't any settled dust or anything that might have been moved from kids or family members to make sure that your area is clean. Ceiling fans can carry a lot of dust and germs, so turn off your ceiling fan when you're preparing to do an exchange or to start your hemo treatment. Do not position yourself directly in front of an air vent either, because a lot of germs can go through your air vents and come out, and if you're directly in the line of air, that can cause problems with your access possibly. Also consider your lighting. Is your lighting adequate and bright enough to allow you to see to do your PD connection or to cannulate without errors, or are there shadows that might impede your vision? Being prepared for an emergency, such as a fire, a tornado, or a power outage, is also important. Clinics do regular fire and tornado drills as in-center patients, and they also do regular patient education for emergency procedures. Home patients are provided education as well, but your home environment is unique for each patient, and you need to be able to manage an emergency if it happens. Patients and their partners need to keep refreshed on emergency disconnect procedures, so when or if an emergency occurs, you're prepared. Just as clinics need emergency carts, home patients need to have an emergency toolkit with extra supplies such as gauze, tape, syringes, and saline. And it's also important to make sure that you check these supplies regularly to make sure that they're not outdated. A flashlight is also good, and maybe one with that doesn't require a battery, it has a crank, is also good. So if the batteries go bad, you're not stuck without a working flashlight. I find it helpful when I have is a little red toolbox sitting right next to my machine so that if something happens, I can just grab the toolbox and go. It's also good to have a little card or piece of paper in there with the disconnect instructions, because when an event happens, it doesn't happen very often. You might not be refreshed and you might not remember when things are going kind of crazy. It's always safer to have a care partner while doing home dialysis. However, having a partner for home modalities is not a requirement at all centers, and lack of a care partner is not an ultimate barrier to be able to do safely dialysis home modalities. Some clinics will allow a patient to do home hemodialysis alone, but require to have them have an emergency lifeline response system in place so that patients can get 911 assistance at the touch of a button. One patient reported using baby monitors so that her husband could work in his home office while she dialyzed in the bedroom. I've used cell phones so that my husband can be out in the yard or somewhere else in the house and I can reach him if I need it, but he doesn't have to be right there with me at all times while I'm on the machine. There are a couple of other factors that home patients have to manage that most clinics do not, and that's children and pets. It is important to take special care to keep your supplies out of reach of children, as well as puppies or kittens who like to chew on things or play with things. I also make sure that neither my children or my pets are in my treatment area when I'm cannulating or starting my treatment. This is especially important for PD patients when doing an exchange so that they're not at risk for peritonitis. Not only is there a high risk for contamination, but there's also a distraction. The distraction can increase chances for error in your procedures for doing an exchange or hooking up to the machine. I had a problem once when I had three children talking to me at once and the television going, and it can easily cause a problem with a clotted access or having to be restuck or not being able to get your treatment done because there's so much going on that it's hard to pay attention. With pets, it's good to have a separate area where they're not allowed to go to help your treatment area stay clean and free from germs, especially a peritoneal dialysis patient. It's nice to have a separate area just to do exchanges, where if pets can't go, they're less likely to have a contaminated area. The most important thing I want to impress upon listeners is that it's important for you to be aware of safety infection precautions as well as emergency preparedness so that you can advocate for yourself and take an active role in your treatment and care. And if you have questions about why something is being done or not done, ask. It's your care, it's your quality of life. And if you don't get a satisfactory answer, ask again or speak to a supervisor. Thank you for giving me this opportunity, Sheila.
Thanks so much, Norma. It's so important for listeners to hear from you, an empowered patient who has learned how to take control of your health. I'd like to introduce now our third and final speaker, Lisa Hall. Lisa is the Community Services Coordinator for the Florida End-Stage Renal Disease Network, that's Network 7. Lisa served as the project lead for a 2005-2006 CMS special study called Developing Strategies and Strategic Partnerships to Overcome Disasters. In addition, Lisa has led the network's grievance system and directs all the activities of the Vocational Rehab Advisory Council. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Sheila. I appreciate you inviting me to this call today. Emergency preparedness and response is obviously a very important area to be addressed, and the new conditions for coverage have really made some changes that are going to affect patients' lives throughout the country. The new standards for emergency preparedness require that facilities must implement processes and procedures to manage medical and non-medical emergencies that are likely to threaten the health and safety of patients, staff, or the public. These emergencies can include, but are not limited to, fires, equipment or power failures, care-related emergencies, water supply interruptions, and natural disasters that are likely to occur in a particular geographic area or region. Every dialysis facility must have a facility-specific disaster and emergency plan and be able to respond accordingly. Facilities have to consider the potential of and develop a plan for natural disasters in their location. So if you're in Florida, obviously you're going to be concerned about hurricanes. For those folks who are anywhere on the Gulf Coast, for that matter, earthquakes in California, ice storms in the northern states. So it's very important in whatever region of the country you live in, you check with your dialysis facility and providers to see that they're prepared for hazards that might occur in their area. And, of course, there should be an all-hazards approach to preparedness because you never know what might occur in any area of the country. And then also man-made disasters can occur, like fires in the facility or the area of a facility, or power or water supply disruptions. Staff at dialysis facilities are required to be prepared, and they have to demonstrate this preparedness. They have to demonstrate that they've taught patients what to do, where to go, and that includes instructions for occasions when the geographic area has to be evacuated, which, of course, we recently saw with Hurricanes Gustav and Ike. And who to contact if an emergency occurs while the patient's not in the dialysis facility. This contact has to be an alternate phone number for the facility, because if your facility has no power and you're calling the facility to see what their operations are, you're not going to be able to get through on the line. So facilities are required to have a backup phone number that's provided to you at all times, that's available to you year-round, because a disaster can occur at any time. And that can be a toll-free 800 number. It can be a mailbox in the sky. It can be maybe rolled over into one of the staff members' cell numbers. But there has to be something that you know you're supposed to do when you can't contact folks. And then finally, the facilities have to teach patients how to disconnect themselves from the dialysis machine if an emergency occurs. And when facilities are doing the patient training, the patients have to have knowledge and be able to demonstrate knowledge of how to handle emergencies, both inside the facilities, for instance, if the machines are not working and they have to disconnect, and also out of the facility, what they would do at home, how they would take care of evacuation, sheltering, and things like that if there were a disaster. Patients and their family members should be prepared for what they do if they can't get their regular dialysis treatment, which often occurs when there's a disaster that's large scale. There could be several days lag time for treatment. And they have to include in that their dietary precautions. So they need to be talking with their physician about what the emergency diet is and what recommendations are made in their specific case, but also there are some tools and resources available that Sheila will make available to everyone that give some guides for emergency diet. Regarding emergency equipment and facilities, all facilities now are required to have emergency equipment, which includes but is not limited to oxygen, airways, suction, defibrillator, or an automated external defibrillator, that's also known as the AED, artificial resuscitator, and emergency drugs. These have to be on premises at all times and immediately available. The facility's emergency plans have to include specific components that were not required in the regulations before, and these are spelled out very clearly, and the facilities must follow them. They have to have a plan to obtain emergency medical system assistance when needed, which is usually calling 911 or another system, maybe if they're a hospital-based facility. Every year, they have to evaluate the effectiveness of their disaster plan and update them. That should include a review of any medical or non-medical emergencies. And the way that's done is if there's a potential emergency or something goes wrong in the facility, at that time, during the emergency and certainly after, they should look at everything that occurred step by step and see if there's something that was missing in their plan that they need to put into their plan, and they need to add and update their plan so that the next time that particular glitch will not occur. The facilities have to at least once a year conduct drills or mock emergencies in order to determine the staff's skill level and educational needs and effectiveness of their plans. So ask your facilities about their dialysis or their emergency drills. And that's, I can't emphasize that enough. In working with the disaster coalitions in various states and throughout the country, and also in working on our own internal emergency plans, and even in my home plan, I find that I've learned each time that there's always room for improvement, and there are several glitches, like a phone number might be wrong, or a contact name might not be available that I thought was available. So I think it's really important to test your plans every time there's a potential emergency and see how that went, and critically look at it and make changes. The emergency planning, I can't stress enough, is a continual year-round process. And the facilities also must contact the local disaster management agency, which is usually called your emergency operations center or your emergency management center or your EOC. But your local emergency managers, they have to contact them at least annually to be sure that that agency is aware of what dialysis patients need. In 2004, we had four hurricanes that hit the state of Florida within a 45-day period, and I was involved in response to that in Florida throughout the state. And one time, I had to contact the state emergency managers and ask for water because there were facilities that didn't have water in order to do dialysis. And the state emergency managers, not knowing better, thought that we needed bottled water. And they were going to send out a tanker truck of bottled water. And, of course, I had to let them know that what we needed was potable water, 100 gallons per patient per treatment for the affected area. And I believe this was during Hurricane Charlie. So, obviously, we recognized in Florida the opportunity for education to emergency managers so that they can help respond to us better because they simply didn't know what our needs were. And I think we should all practice that whether a patient or a family member or a dialysis facility, every time someone doesn't know what it is that you need, it's an opportunity for education. Facilities also should collaborate with their end-stage renal disease, or ESRD, networks, suppliers, utility providers, and state agencies for survey, which, of course, Kelly, who spoke earlier, works with for emergency preparedness. Just briefly, the ESRD networks, there's 18 networks that Medicare contracts with to help all the dialysis facilities throughout the country to provide quality care to patients. So the facilities, for instance, in Florida, I work with the network that oversees Florida, facilities can contact the networks and ask for help in doing a better job with patients. And sometimes the networks have to contact the facilities to work with them and provide some technical assistance so they can do a better job with emergencies. Just briefly, I'm going to tell you about the Kidney Community Emergency Response Coalition, which is a national disaster coalition. National Kidney Foundation has been very involved in this coalition, as has every kidney patient and provider organization in the country. It was formed in 2006 in an effort to minimize the disruption to life-sustaining dialysis and transplant services related to disasters. It was formed before Hurricane Katrina, but I think it became a larger-scale coalition with more people involved, more of the key partners involved, after Katrina occurred and all the lessons that were learned with Katrina. There are also state agencies and federal agencies on this coalition, and patients in need of assistance, of course, should work with their local dialysis provider for planning for the for disasters, or transplant provider if you're a transplant patient, and your local emergency management office, and then your local end-stage renal disease network. And Sheila is going to provide resources so that you can know how to contact your end-stage renal disease network. But if none of the local efforts are able to assist you, then the National Disaster Coalition is able to assist that area that's affected. Some brief preparedness tips, and I'll wind up, just so you can kind of keep in mind what you need to do yourself to prepare for disasters, is find out what disasters are likely to happen in your neighborhood, in your community. Find out how you're going to receive a warning about disasters. Find out how to prepare for disasters that are likely to happen. For instance, the 3-day emergency diet or disaster diet, having basic supplies that most people need in disasters, not just dialysis patients, the proper water and medicine, radios and clothing, blankets, those things that are recommended by your local emergency managers. Make copies of all your important documents. Choose an out-of-area contact person, and that way if all the phone systems are down or overloaded in your particular area, then probably phones will work if there's an area code outside of your general region. And most important after what we saw with Hurricane Ike is make a plan on how you would evacuate if you're told to, and be ready to do it at a moment's notice. Unfortunately, many patients did not evacuate the Galveston area with Hurricane Ike, and the outcomes were not good. And it was very difficult for those of us who are in the business of saving lives and of helping people to prepare to when they chose not to evacuate, because they had plenty of time and plenty of opportunity to get prepared and to leave the area. Ask your care team what to do if a disaster strikes your treatment center, and ask your pharmacy about getting a supply of medicines and any needed medical supplies for your disaster supply kit. Transplant recipients, this is very important, because I know you have a lot of medications and you have to be concerned about having those on hand and infection and other areas that can affect transplant recipients. And just remember, most importantly, just to take care of yourself if a disaster strikes. There's two websites that Sheila's going to point you to. One is the Kidney Community Emergency Response Coalition website, and also the National Kidney Foundation has a lot of resources for patients and providers that can help prepare dialysis and transplant patients for disasters. And the final comment is, we have developed, all of the coalition developed together, some patient identification cards that are, if they haven't already been delivered, are being delivered within the next week or so to your facility. And they're small purple identification cards that say, I am a dialysis patient. And it's an opportunity to write on this card your vital information, your medicines, your doctor, the name of your dialysis facility, your prescription. And also it's considered to be an ID so that if there were checkpoints where you couldn't get through during disasters and you had to prove that you're a dialysis patient and you have that, or if you're at a shelter and you want to prove that you need to get to a center as soon as possible, as soon as the disasters die down so that you can get there, then these cards are helpful. So ask your facilities about these, and if your facilities don't know about them, they can contact their local end-stage renal disease network, and they can make sure the facilities have them. And that concludes my presentation remarks, and again, I appreciate you asking me to speak on this important topic, Sheila.
Lisa, thank you very much, and we appreciate that you brought to our attention the importance of preparing for a disaster. As Lisa mentioned, if you go to the Coffee House Conversations website, www.kidney.org/coffeehouse, by the end of tomorrow, you will find a link on that website that will take you to resources that are appropriate to today's call. So these resources will address the issues of safety and emergency preparedness that we've been discussing on today's call. I'd like to begin our question and answer session now. And again, thank you very much to our faculty, Kelly, Norma, and Lisa, for your informative presentation.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Conrad Slanina, your line is open.
I was not aware of the term. I have several questions, but the very first one is it possible that these three presentations, that we could have a copy of them? I don't hear very well, and I think I missed some of it, and I would also like to give a copy to my dialysis people, one of our head nurses down there. Is that possible?
Thank you very much for your question, and we appreciate hearing from you. As a matter of fact, these presentations are all going to be available on the website, www.kidney.org/coffeehouse, starting tomorrow. So you will be able to go to that website and find a link to hear the audio of today's session and also our previous Coffee House Conversations calls.
Excellent. Marie, I can't read. I'm completely blind. My wife has a question about that last website address. Would you repeat it for her?
Yes, certainly. That's www.kidney.org, O-R-G, O-R-G.
O-R-G only once?
O-R-G once, I'm sorry, / coffee house, all one word.
Last coffee, she has it. Okay, you had mentioned 100 gallons of water per treatment. There's so many things that I don't know. Is this something that is new? I can't imagine that they're using any kind of that volume of any liquid for my treatment. And I do believe I have some old machines where I'm getting treated.
This is Lisa. I'll be glad to answer that. That's how much water is required at a minimum, 100 gallons of treated pressurized water for use in the dialysis treatment. Obviously, that's there at the facility, and I'm not a water expert, so I'll let one of the technical people on the call assist with this, but that's the amount of water that's needed.
Kelly, would you like to add something to Lisa's response?
I do know that per week, that patients are exposed to about 360 liters per week of water with the dialysis treatment.
Okay, you were saying 360 liters per week. I'm sorry, were you finished?
Yes.
Okay, 360 a week, since I presume everybody has three treatments a week, it happens to be 120 liters per treatment. I'm on a machine for 3.5 hours, and let me just stop and visualize 100 and how many did I say for treatment? 120? 120 liters, which would be for about approximately 30 gallons. I'm doing this mentally, and I'm pretty close, I think. The only liquid that I see, and I don't think it's water because it evacuates rapidly. There's two containers. Each of them are probably about 2.5 gallons of liquid. I have no idea what that liquid is, but it's certainly not the volume that you're talking about. Nor is it water, because they tell me that it evacuates rapidly.
Excuse me, but I'm having a hard time hearing you. I don't know if it's your telephone, but you are breaking up a little bit, so I think we will have to go on and take the next question.
Okay.
But feel free to call back on another line, and perhaps we'll have an easier time hearing you.
Would you mind answering one more question?
As I said, it's hard for us to hear you because there's something wrong with the line. Your voice is breaking up.
Okay, I'm sorry, but thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Yes, Samuel Smith.
Samuel Smith, your line is open.
Yeah, they said the techs and nurses are supposed to wash their hand between patients.
Yes.
All I see, they change gloves, but they don't wash their hands between patients. Before they, connect the patient or touching the machine, they're supposed to wash their hands from different machines or just hooking the patient up, supposed to wash their hands?
That's an excellent question, and we will try to clarify that for you.
Yeah. Sheila, this is Kelly, and yes, under the rules for the requirements for infection control, staff do need to be wearing gloves when they touch the dialysis machine or when they touch the
the dialyzer lines during the dialysis treatment or touch that patient's access. And gloves do need to be removed and hands either washed. They're washed if they have visible, if they're visibly soiled, or that antiseptic hand sanitizer is appropriate if the hands are not visibly dirty. The gloves need to be removed and the hands washed or use of a hand sanitizer prior to moving on to the next patient.
Okay. Okay. I don't think it's being done at my unit. I don't think those rules are being followed.
Okay.
And you say, one more question.
Sure.
You said the Hep B patients should be isolated or the HIV patients should be isolated. They should have isolation unit for them?
The regulations address only the hepatitis B positive patients for isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, facilities could use an isolation if they do not have a hepatitis B positive patient on census. Some facilities do use that isolation room for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But the
okay.
facility needs to inform patients of the policy for that isolation room.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like us to address the issue that you raised in your first question about observing improper hand-washing practices. And maybe one of our expert faculty panel members could respond to that and give a few suggestions as to what a patient might do if he or she does observe such unsafe practices. Norma or Kelly, would you like to respond?
Yep, this is Kelly, and I'll respond. Is that really, it's the patient's right to receive safe care, and so you should tell staff if you don't feel comfortable with how they're washing hands, explain to them that, you know, there are some new requirements in dialysis facilities and that you did observe that they didn't wash hands and that their hands should be washed. And these regulations are new and that staff are, you know, there are changes to staff in the way that they're providing care with these new regulations. And so staff are getting used to using these new regulations. But that's part of the facility's responsibility also is to educate staff. The facility should be educating staff, and both new staff and existing staff, on these new regulations, and that's a requirement.
Thank you, Kelly. Norma, I'm wondering if you have anything you could add about the role as a self-advocate, as a patient trying to be a self-advocate, and what are some suggestions you might have for approaching staff about such a concern?
I think it's very important for patients to be an advocate for themselves, and if you see something not being done, it doesn't mean that you need to point it out in a negative way. You can just ask, I see this happening, and I don't understand. Can you share with me your policy on washing hands and infection control so I can understand better why things are being done the way they are? And if you think it disagrees or is a discrepancy between what you think should be done, point that out and say, I understood it to be this way. I understood the regulations to mean this. Can you clarify? The team care meeting is also a very good place to bring up issues. If you see things going on over time, if you see something going wrong, you need to bring it up immediately. But if you have ongoing concerns, the team care meeting with the nurse, the doctor, the social worker, and the dietitian, and the patient should be there, is a good place to bring up concerns that you see aren't being resolved.
Norma, thank you. That's an excellent point. And on our next Coffee House Conversations call, which is entitled Getting the Care You Need, our faculty will address topics including the initial assessment and care planning process for patients and the care team. So that's a good introduction, and listeners can certainly keep that in mind. I think we'll take our next question now, please.
Matt Lukowski, your line is open.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Is it correct that we're supposed to have a number for the clinic and also a backup number to call?
This is Lisa. That's correct. The facility needs to give you a phone number that you can call if their facility is not operable. There, so that you need to ask for that, and that should be available to you, that information should be available to you year-round. The facility could roll that over to somebody's home, to somebody's cell phone, or it could be an 800 number or some sort of voice mailbox that will give you a key message, a voice mailbox that might be off-site or in some other geographic area that's not affected.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your question. We'll take the next question, please.
Shirley McBride Randall, your line is open.
Yes, my question has to do about blood pressure. What's considered too high or too low to be at the end of your dialysis treatment?
Would one of our faculty members like to take this question?
I can answer that from a patient perspective. I don't know exactly how clinical it is.
Okay, well, Norma, why don't you take a stab at it, and then we can add on to your response.
Normal blood pressure should be under 140 for the top number and under 80 for the bottom number. Dialysis patients tend to run a little bit higher. You tend to come in with a higher blood pressure and leave with a lower blood pressure. I usually come off about 110 to over 70 as my takeoff, and if it's any lower than that, you're starting to get dehydrated. Some patients can come off a little bit lower, and they normally run low. But low blood pressure at the end is a sign that you're getting a little bit too dry, and high means that you're not getting dry enough. Your target weight might need to be changed.
So then it's okay to go home?
Well, the nurses at your clinic will assess you. There's a lot of things that they look at.
But they don't assess me. My blood pressure has been 220 over 100, and I've been told, you okay, go home.
I would address that with your doctor.
You know, Shirley, that's an excellent question and certainly something that you're right to be concerned about. During our next call, Getting the Care You Need, we'll be talking about the care planning process, and part of this includes a discussion of what's called adequacy, and that has to do with whether or not your dialysis prescription is correct, whether or not you're reaching target blood pressures, whether or not you're reaching target hemoglobin levels, which has to do with anemia, which is a problem for many people receiving dialysis. So I urge you to listen to our next call, and hopefully we'll be able to provide you more information about adequacy and reaching these target levels.
Okay. Sheila, Jim Curtis has a comment on blood pressure.
Yeah, and blood pressure varies so much from patients, and usually if you're getting dry, your blood pressure will tend to drop, but some people have an extra compensatory system that will cause the blood pressure to go up. So it really is something that you need to talk with your physician about and get it figured out as to exactly why the blood pressure is so high, because it should never be that high regardless of what else is going on with your fluid levels. So.
And if I could just add to what Jim has said, in the care planning team meeting, all of your healthcare team members are participating, and you'll hear next time that the team is required to ask you if you would like to participate. And that's a very good place and a very good time to have this discussion.
I wanted to know about that team care meeting. They may have a team care meeting, but I, as a patient, have never been invited to a team care meeting.
Okay.
And the other thing is, you said discuss the difference in my blood pressure with my doctor. The doctors don't stand still long enough for you to ask them anything.
Well, we appreciate hearing that, and we also want to urge you to share with your healthcare team that you know the new regulations do require that you be invited to participate in your care planning team meeting. So we'll talk more about that next time, Shirley, and I hope you can join us for our next call. And that's going to be on January 14th, that's Wednesday, from 3 to 4:30 Eastern Time.
I've already registered for that.
Excellent. Well, we'll be anxious to hear from you next time, and thank you very much for your question.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, this is Kelly, and I would just like to add that also there is a requirement in the regulations, specifically on assessment, that blood pressure does need to be assessed and fluid management needs to be looked at along with all with weight gains and target weight, the pre-post blood pressures and the blood pressures during treatment, and then a care plan established with that assessment. So that is a requirement.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
I think we'll take our next question now, please.
Richard Coper, your line is open.
Yes, I was listening to your topic on the purple cards that you're going to give out to dialysis patients. Is that something that's going to be given out to transplant people as well?
It's a good question, and there is not, at this point, an identifying card for transplant patients. If you have interest in following up with that, I think if you go to the website for Coffee House Conversations, there'll be a link to the CASER Coalition where you can ask a question by just clicking on the CASER Coalition's email, contact us. And if you want to get involved in discussion of that, we have a lot of people from throughout the transplant community that are planning future resources and tools that are important for all people with end-stage renal disease.
The patient assistance team is looking at cards for transplant patients as well.
So that's already being reviewed, and if you'd like to be involved in that dialogue, then feel free to.
And Lisa, if I could just add to what you've said, and thank you for your response. Even though right now we don't have identification cards for transplant recipients, and I say we because I've been involved in the Kidney Community Emergency Response Coalition as well, we have been looking at the importance of emergency preparedness for transplant recipients as well, and we've been developing materials for that population. So we haven't forgotten about you. But thank you very much for your question, Richard.
Thank you.
Our next question, please.
Althea Luce, your line is open.
Good afternoon. How's everybody doing? This is my first time participating. My question is this, is that in listening to the panelists about some of the things that the we as patients can look out, you know, for, like one of the patients had a question about, you know, the hand washing. We're talking about the cards. There's several things that occur in the clinic. My question to you is that who oversees where not only the patients have to kind of be the police, I guess you want to call it, but who oversees in each clinic to make sure that these things are happening, like monitoring, where you don't have to wait till a patient either calls someone out because, you know, where I go, I don't see a lot of patients that's probably able to speak up or see anything because they're sick, number one. A lot of them are older, you know, and then there's a lot of also people who are afraid to say anything because you have to understand these people put the needles in, they take the needles out. And so I'm just wondering what responsibility per kidney center and who's monitoring to make sure that happens besides the patient?
Those are excellent questions. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
My name is Althea.
Althea.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You've raised several important points that I think we will try to address. Which of our faculty members would like to start?
This is Kelly, and I'll start. The dialysis facility, the new regulations do require that the facility have internal mechanisms for oversight of their infection control policies and activities within the dialysis facility, and that any problems are reported to the medical director and to that quality assessment and performance improvement committee, which is the interdisciplinary team, and that those areas are evaluated, and then if there's a problem identified, that there is a plan made and corrective action is taken. Also, surveyors and states do make unannounced visits to the facilities, and part of what surveyors do is actually observe care. And so surveyors, like myself, we go to the dialysis facilities and watch. We watch care, we watch hand washing, we watch infection control. Also, we are there, though, for You're there all the time. Patients are there all the time. Surveyors are at the facility for several days. So we have a snapshot picture. Surveyors do talk to patients also, and so it is important that patients feel free to talk to surveyors and let them know of concerns that they're seeing also. Surveyors do keep interviews with patients confidential, and that we also use many mechanisms to corroborate what patients say. So we'd watch, we'd observe, but it helps us see areas that may be a concern that we also should be watching. And in interviews with patients also could be, we can call patients. Patients should know also that if patients don't feel comfortable talking at the dialysis facility, because sometimes it's not always private, that we're more than willing to call later, call the patient at home, or have the patient call us, and that's great also to talk privately.
So I guess who actually oversees the monitoring of these regulations in the dialysis unit? Was that also part of your question, Althea?
Yeah, it's because and I hear what you guys are saying, and I guess as a patient, and what any other patient out there can speak on that, and what we see, because you're right, we're there. But what I see personally is myself, who I'm a very strong advocate for myself and others, is that sometimes it's kind of a touchy thing. Now, these surveyors that you talk about, I've seen some people, and I assume they're surveys. They don't work there, but they come in, they come like once, you know, they've been there for about a week, and they're walking around. I've never seen a demonstration of them not coming to me nor talking to anyone else other than observing the technician. And the techs are very aware that they're being observed. So, I mean, I guess I feel a little bit confused on that. It's kind of like when Ellen and I is coming to check something, but sometimes people are notified, like the director, so everybody's on their best behavior.
Althea, this is Lisa.
Okay.
She brought up some very important points.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not comfortable, you feel like the environment isn't safe for you to make a complaint, one thing that can be done first is possibly help get the social worker to assist with advocacy. And if that doesn't work, there's phone numbers posted in your facility waiting area where you can call toll-free the state agency or your ESRD network. They're 800 numbers, and you can complain anonymously or make your name known. But I think first the facility, if you feel comfortable with it, can and should make their complaint and grievance process available to you, which includes and involves the medical director. The medical director is supposed to be very involved in that complaint process.
Sure.
But if that does not occur or you don't feel comfortable using that, then you certainly can call a state agency, the surveyors, or the ESRD network toll-free, and we will oversee your concerns.
Lisa, thank you. And actually, our last call about the conditions for coverage is entitled Know Your Rights and Responsibilities, and that call is being held on Wednesday, February 11th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So we will be talking a good deal about the complaint and grievance process and what your rights and responsibilities are. So I urge you to join us for that call, Althea. And
when is that again?
That's on Wednesday, February 11th.
Okay.
Can I add something?
Yes.
This is Norma. When the surveyors come, they don't speak to every patient, but they usually post a sign that says that they're there, and if patients would like to speak, one of them to notify a designated person.
Okay, I've never seen that, and that's the only reason why I'm asking that question. I've never seen that. I've never been participating in it. I heard you guys mention something about the team. There's a team, and that the patient... Never heard of that. I mean, I've been a dialysis patient for 2 years.
Well, let me assure you that these dialysis regulations are new, and that hopefully over the next several weeks and several months, you will see some changes in your dialysis unit. They work to comply with the new regulations.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have time for one and possibly two more questions.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Rosalind Bowman, your line is open.
Yes, I'd like to ask about in-home hemodialysis. How is the quality of water controlled during treatment if something should happen to the water supply or something contaminates the water? I know in-center it's being monitored continuously, but at home we only do a couple of strips before we go on the machine.
Norma, would you like to answer that question?
Well, my situation is a little bit different because I use NxStage, and so I'll make a batch, and my water is either the pure flow is pumped into a 60-gallon tub, or I use prepackaged bags, so it can't be compromised once it's made. Someone who knows a little more about home hemo on a conventional machine might have a different answer. I'm not familiar with that water treatment.
Norma, Jim Curtis can assist.
Yes. With the new regulations, they're required to have a dual bicarb or carbon tank system for removing the chlorine. So when you test your chlorine before your treatment, and the test strip shows that it's good and you can use that water, you have a completely redundant system that will get you through at least a dialysis treatment. So as long as the chlorine test is good before you start, you know that you have enough capacity to remove all of the chlorine throughout that treatment, and you'll test it again before the next treatment. All of the water treatment system itself, or the reverse osmosis treatment, has a built-in monitor that measures the quality of the water by a conductivity meter. And so that will alarm if something changes during the treatment. So as long as you've tested that before your treatment starts, you're good to go for a treatment and retest before the next one.
And this is Kelly, and I'll add also that there are requirements also for the water and dialysate cultures to be drawn with that conventional dialysis system also. And that needs to be done quarterly, along with chemical analysis of the water. And that needs to be done at least annually, and then along with any, if there are any seasonal changes that occur that might indicate a need to check the water.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I would like to especially thank Jim Curtis, who is on the call today as an unexpected faculty participant. And Jim, thank you for joining us and for sharing the information that you know so well about water quality. I think we have time for one more question.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Cheryl Wilson, your line is open.
Yes, I want to ask, I have a catheter. And I was wondering, how long can they leave the catheters in?
Excellent question, Cheryl. I guess I would like to ask our faculty if there is something in the regulations, and if that would be part of the discussion about adequacy, and maybe we could answer it from that framework.
Okay.
And this is Kelly. And there is a requirement on assessment that access is be evaluated. And so that team, which would include the nurse and social worker, dietitian, physician, and you, are looking at that catheter to see if that's the most appropriate treatment for you, and to see if evaluation is being done to see if there's another access that would be right for you, such as a fistula or a graft. And then there, along with that, there does need to be a plan of care established regarding that access. And that may be, for example, even referral for others, for professionals to look at your veins to see if it would be acceptable for a fistula or graft.
Okay, what if there's not any other access at the top?
I would say, Cheryl, that everybody's health condition is different, and the doctor, as you said, you may not have an opportunity to have another type of access because of your particular health condition.
Yes.
So that is something that the doctor and the healthcare team would need to discuss with you on an individual basis. I know that some individuals do have catheters in place for several years. Often it's recommended that an individual be evaluated for an AV fistula, which has fewer complications, but in your case, that may not be a consideration. So, again, this is the type of thing that you would discuss with your healthcare team at the care planning team meeting.
Okay.
Thank you, Cheryl, for your question. I think it's time now for us to conclude today's call. I would just like to mention a few things. Again, please take a moment to visit the website. That's www.kidney.org/coffeehouse. By tomorrow, we will have several things posted on that website pertaining to today's call. And we ask that you take a few minutes to complete a survey about today's call, and you can link to that from our coffeehouse website. In addition, you will find educational materials and resources that you can link to. And you can also sign up for the next two calls coming up on the website. In addition to that, you will have an email address that you can click on the website to send any questions or comments you have about today's call, the previous call, or any upcoming calls. We hope that you all join us next time, and we thank you very much for joining us for today's Coffee House Conversations call. Thank you, Sheila.